This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here, but much more importantly, Dr. Sara Molino, the professor of history emerita for Guilford College, is our very special guest. Doctor, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Let's start from the beginning. I know you're a professor of history, but let's do a little bit of your history and right from the beginning. Where were you born and where were you raised?
I was actually born in Omaha, Nebraska. My mother grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and my dad was in the Navy. It was just towards the end of World War II, and they were stationed in some obscure place in Washington State. And my father was worried that there wouldn't be proper medical facilities in that place in Washington State. I'm sure there were, but anyway, he sent my mother home to have me. He was still on active duty. And so he met me when I was 6 weeks old. He had finished law school before he went into the Navy. And so he was in the Judge Advocate Corps during World War II, but he was anxious to be part of the war effort, as was my mother. I mean, they were convinced, they were of that generation who really believed that the war they were fighting was the good war. And so my mother after she finished college, she went to about a 6-month engineering course and then worked in an airplane factory for a short time, had met my father when she was in college in Boston and he was in law school. And then they were married, a couple years later, right, towards the end of the war. And I'm their first child, born 9 months after they were married.
You have to pardon my ignorance on this, but when you hear Omaha, Nebraska, and maybe it's just a bad stereotype, the first thing that you think of isn't education, but both of your parents are so well educated. Is that a departure from what others, their neighbors or friends and neighbors would have been in that particular area?
Not really. I mean, my mother's father was a butcher. He was the child of immigrants. Both of my parents were descendants of Eastern European immigrants. My mother was second generation. My father was first generation. And my grandfather essentially produced, as part of the Midwest, they migrated there as many, there were a numbers of Jewish families that immigrated throughout the country. I would have to look and check about what their path was. I don't remember that, but though I do have in the other room somebody who wrote a history of the Kulikovsky family. But anyway, he and his four brothers moved to Omaha, and their relatives were there. Their grandparents were there too, so they brought the family. And he ran a meat business in which he butchered meat for restaurants and places like that in Omaha. And then he also ran a kind of specialty grocery store. So he was a very hardworking man. He had a year of college, and then his father died, and he had to come home and do the family business. And that was what he did his entire life. And then, so my mother, and he made a good living doing that in Omaha, and was surrounded by his family. And my mother's own mother, he married my grandmother in 1916, and we actually have the diary that she wrote. His name was J.H. Kulikovsky, and she said, "I now the grandmother." My grandmother said, I now understand what, on her wedding day, she said, I now understand what JHK stands for, just heavenly kisses. And I love that yeah. part. I mean, we found, yeah. you know, we dug through all her stuff when my mother was ready to move out of her house. And we found this diary, which is just an incredible treasure. She grew up there and then her own mother died when she was a baby. And so my grandfather married another woman who, with the family thought, you know, he needs a wife. He's got these two little daughters. And he was in deep mourning. So they found him a wife who was very appropriate, but that woman was college educated and a socialist. My grandfather was a Republican, so that she voted for Norman Thomas and he voted for whoever the Republican candidate was. They canceled each other's votes out. But she was, I mean, that's the woman whom I grew up with as my grandmother, because my original grandmother was gone, you know, when my mother was a child. But she was an artist, and I do have some paintings. So they had sent her to art school. I mean, education was very, you know, the step to upward mobility for Jewish families. And so, so sending my mother to college was, you know, she was a good student in high school. She did her work, and somebody came into my grandfather's store and said to him, I'm sending my daughter to this school back east. Maybe Beth would be interested in that. And so my grandfather came home and said to my mother, how would you like to go to this school in Boston? And my mother said, sure. She didn't know. And so she ended up in Massachusetts, and that's where she, and my father's family all lived in Worcester, Mass. They immigrated there, and those grandparents were from Latvia. My mother's parents were from Lithuania, and they, you know, so they were already wanting to be American. And, you know, my grandparents on my father's side used to speak to him in Yiddish, and he would answer them in English. He was determined, you know, to be a different generation. So the Midwest turned out to be a place of opportunity for both of them. It's a long story how they got there, but I won't go into that detail.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. Let me remind folks mm-hmm. that just may be tuning in or turning on their radio, Frank McKay here, but more importantly, Dr. Sarah Molino is our very special guest, and we'll be finding out a lot more about this amazing woman as time goes on. And again, we're talking a little bit about your history. What about your father's history? When exactly did he join the military?
He joined the military in 1943. He finished law school early in order to be able to do that, and his vision wasn't good enough to fly. So he expected to be shipped out somewhere to the Pacific, but he never got there. And he worked on various military bases in the Judge Advocate Corps because he was a lawyer.
Let me couch this under the category of pardon my ignorance again. But mm-hmm. at the time, did your father mm-hmm. understand anything? Or anticipate anything that we soon would find out about the treatment of the Jews in the concentration camp? When he signed up, was there any knowledge of that whatsoever? Or is that something that came afterwards?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure about that. But I do know that both of my parents were very strong Roosevelt supporters, and they really, you know, they were really committed to his vision of the country. My father's family experienced more hardship during the Depression than my mother's family did, because my grandfather had this lucrative business as a butcher. But and in general, my father's family was much more modest than my mother's, although my mother's was not particularly pretentious. But they, you know, they really had nothing. And my father, you know, earned scholarships and worked through college, and then when he decided to go to law school, also through law school. So I've never asked this question, and it's really an interesting one about whether I'll have to check it with my sister, who's also a historian, whether she knows whether he knew anything. But I do know it was known in the Jewish community in general in the 1940s, and there were delegations of people who went to Roosevelt to try to persuade him to let more Jews into the United States, as, you know, as their family members were writing about to them about conditions in Europe and wanting to get out. And, and there was in Roosevelt's cabinet, and this is, you know, the background that I have as a historian, there was someone, and I can't remember who it is, I'd have to look it up, but there was someone who really did not want more Jews in this country. You know, and during the 30s, too, they also heard on the radio, I remember my mother saying this, actually, they heard Father Coughlin, who was a demagogue and who really spoke very vitriolic, anti-Semitic language. And so there were people in this country who were kind of stirring up an anti-Jewish feeling also. And so they knew that there was danger. I don't know how much they knew about the specifics. And in fact, you know, from what I've read about Hitler, he didn't really figure out. I mean, he was clearly, you know, thought had his views about Jews, but the actual building of the concentration camps and the extermination of the Jews, I think, was a plan hatched in 1942 or something like that. It wasn't. I mean, you know, they clearly were. Working against them, but anyway, so through all the lines of communication between family members in Europe who knew they were in danger and their American relatives, there was plenty of knowledge in the American Jewish community, and there were delegations of rabbis who went to Roosevelt and tried to persuade him to let more Jews in. And there's actually even a story, a terrible story, about a ship of Jews who got all the way to an American port, and they were turned away. So there's a book called When 6 Million Died, and it describes, and there's been many more recent books about this, but the choices that the American government made during that time were not what I would have hoped. And I think not what my family would have hoped.
Another reminder, the voice you're hearing is Dr. Sarah Molino. Frank McKay here with the doctor, and she is a professor of history emerita at Guilford College in Greensboro, North Carolina. And doctor, let me ask you this. What was your first memory of hearing about the Holocaust and the atrocities that happened in and around Europe at that time?
Yeah, I'm not completely sure, because people didn't talk about it very much right in the aftermath. But I do remember being in religious school and meeting, you know, and I knew that my father's family had taken in, you know, relatives who had escaped from Europe. My grandmother raised a whole bunch of, you know, cousins and so on. And I think it was sort of chaotic after the war. That's my impression. You know, it's why Madeleine Albright didn't know she was Jewish. It was because there were people in and out. My first distinct memory is when I was in religious school, I happened to have, when I was about 12, a fantastic teacher who sort of picked out a few of us who were more serious about our learning about Jews and Judaism. And he used to have study groups with us on Saturday afternoons, and we read Night. So I read Elie Wiesel's book Night at about 12 or 13. Wow. And, you know, that is such a vivid description of what transpired in the concentration camps, that certainly stuck with me. And I, you know, and I, so it certainly made me aware that it had taken place. And gradually, you know, over the years, I've read more and more stuff about the Holocaust. And, you know, and it was an issue for the Jewish community because they didn't, you know, first of all, they wanted to take in as many refugees as they possibly could. And I've heard stories from, you know, people who are of my parents' generation who had family in Germany and who went to Germany in 1939 and got them out. So there was an awareness that there was tragedy happening in Europe. And you know, some people refused to go, and that, you know, some were just couldn't believe that they were unwelcome in Germany, a culture which they loved. And so, you know, that's part of the tragedy of that time. But it was certainly part of, it wasn't something my family talked about very much, but it was part of my consciousness by a pretty young age.
Once again, you're listening to the voice of Dr. Sarah Molino, a professor of history emerita at Guilford College, and so much more. She lived abroad in the UK and in Israel, and has just an unbelievable take on history. Frank McKay here with Dr. Molino. Doctor, you mentioned earlier in that answer that...
Please call me Sarah.
Sarah, okay. Sarah, you mentioned earlier in the in your answer that people weren't talking about it. People weren't talking about the Holocaust early on. Now, let me ask you, do you believe, in retrospect, it was because it was so fresh and they didn't know? Or do you think second choice could be it was too horrible to explain, and especially to young children, that you know, that this is just an unbelievable situation? Or do you think there was any fear that, you know, hey, this isn't over yet, and especially by the Jewish people, right, who have just experienced something that you know, has really no precedent in modern history?
Mm-hmm.
Which of those three, if any, are the best answer to that?
I think there were, you know, there were a couple things that happened after World War II that affected Jewish consciousness. And, you know, and I'm speaking in very general terms. Of course, there always are a variety of opinions among Jews. I mean, there's a joke about if you have two Jews, you have three opinions. So, you know, I don't want to oversimplify this.
Sure.
But I think that, first of all, you know, people were in shock that something like this had really happened. And the full extent of it wasn't really known, I think, to the American people until they liberated the camps, and then they saw all those pictures online. You know, not online. They weren't online, obviously.
Well,
were in the newspapers and in the newsreels.
The newsreels,
right? Yes, exactly. They were on the newsreels at that time, and so, you know, so the American public learned about it through the, you know, but also Roosevelt, you know, painted the Nazis and the Japanese and the Italians as the enemy. And he actually, this is a film I used to use in my class that I was thrilled to find. Roosevelt commissioned Frank Capra, who, you know, the famous Hollywood producer, to do a series of films on
Why We Fight
on World War II, called Why We Fight.
Yeah.
And these films, he loved them so much that he wanted them shown in every movie theater throughout the country to explain to the people why they were involved in this war. And the first one of these films is the one that I often showed. And they said, and the question was, why are we at war? And he In this film, Capra stereotypes the Nazis, the Germans, the Italians, and the Japanese. And he says these are three monsters, and you know, if you ever see them and you have your gun, don't hesitate to shoot them.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. And there's patriotic music through the entire movie. I mean, when I showed it to 20th and 21st century students, they were just, you know, they laughed because it was so obviously meant as propaganda.
Right.
But Roosevelt loved these films, and so people had these ideas. And certainly after Pearl Harbor, and I'm sure that was probably, now that I think about it, that's probably what provoked my father to join the Navy,
yeah.
Was after Pearl Harbor, then the Americans had been attacked, and then there was no question that we had to join the war. But we, you know, we hesitated for a long time, even though the government certainly knew what was happening in Europe. And you know, so I think that people were in shock. I think, you know, more and more research has been done about the details of what actually happened.
Well, hey, Dr. Molino, let me ask you to keep your thought for 1 second. We're going to take a quick break. Frank McKay here with Dr. Sarah Molino. Talking history in a very dark part of the history of the 20th century, and we're talking about quite a bit about the Holocaust. We'll be back right after this. I'd like to welcome everyone back to Breaking It Down. Frank McKay here, but much more importantly, Dr. Sarah Molino, a professor of history emerita from Guilford College down in North Carolina, and she's lived in Israel, she's lived in the UK, and she has a wonderful take on history and just an expert on so much. Thrilled to talk to her, Sarah. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Right before the break, you got into the Frank Capra films, Why We Fight,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, I've seen them, and they're laughable nowadays. And of course, Capra was such a great storyteller. You know, It's a Wonderful Life,
and
Happened One Night, and all of these great award-winning films and everything else. And he was beloved, and he told these fairy tales that were so lovable and everything else. And when you see those, you're right. I mean, when you show them to modern day students, it's laughable because that's what we were looking at. Not to knock you off track here, but you mentioned that FDR loved these films. Did he love these films for the entertainment value, or did he see that these were helpful in educating the people, or maybe even the red meat that people needed to support the war?
Well, I think it was a different time, and we just have to realize that, you know, we live in a very different world from the world of Roosevelt and the world of the 1940s. I mean, that's already, you know, more than 50, 60. My math is not, math is not my strength. I just need a pencil and a piece of paper to figure it out, but how many years ago it was. But I guess we've recently celebrated the 50th anniversary, you know, so on. I think Roosevelt, you know, Roosevelt felt that the wonderful story about Roosevelt and Frank Capra is that when Roosevelt thought up, or Roosevelt's advisors thought up, the idea of getting Capra to make these films, this series of films, he said to Capra, "I want you to make documentaries about why we're in the war." And Capra said, "Excuse me, sir, I've never made a documentary before." And Roosevelt said, "I've never fought a war before." So the two of them, sort of leaped into this process. And as the films develop, they are a combination of actual documentary footage from the time, of a kind of cartoon depiction of the world, and a very oversimplified. I mean, they do explain in that first one that because of the Depression during the 1930s, that people in Europe suffered after World War, the solution after World War I left no one happy, really. And so the people were starving, and it was an opportunity, a historical opportunity for demagogues like Mussolini and Hitler and the Emperor of Japan to mobilize their people for a cause, and they felt that somehow they would regain the power that they had once had, that they had lost after World War I. And the Japanese weren't involved in World War I, but anyway, they were ready to sign on to World War II. And I may be wrong about that. I'm not a European historian.
Sure.
So all of this is explained in the, what was our life like during the 1930s in those films. And they are pictures of Americans, who are trying to recover from World War I. They're working in industry, blah, 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 et cetera. And their children are playing happily on the playground. They're undisturbed by the effects of World War I. Their lives are better than the lives of people in Europe. And so, they were persuasive to a very white, non-multicultural approach to, whitewashed approach to American history that is taken in those films. They do quote in some of those films in this first film particularly, that some American people didn't feel that we needed to be involved in a war. And, he explains that the world is smaller now because of airplanes. And so there is a global threat, and that we need to mobilize in order to face this global threat of these three demagogues in Europe. And I think, I think this kind of, they're way oversimplified, but they are, they're sort of appealing, and they play patriotic music through the whole thing. And so they may have been effective, but whether or not, I don't know how they affected the American public mind. That would be a subject for another
sure.
study, but they certainly were widely shown. They were shown all the time, and they were, and there, I think 11 films in that series. So he did it on each stage of the war, and so they were certainly effective in persuading people that they needed to go to war, and as we spoke about earlier, I think the Jewish community was aware of what many people of more educated members of the Jewish community were aware, or people who had family in Europe were aware that that Jews were in danger there, and yeah. So
Let me once again remind everyone of who our guest is and who they're hearing. Dr. Sarah Molino, professor of history emerita at Guilford College in North Carolina, here with me, Frank McKay. Thrilled to have the doctor. And something we kind of passed over and to switch gears here for a second. You mentioned almost in passing that you're the woman that basically you knew as your grandmother, your grandfather's second wife, was a socialist. And let me ask you, what effect did that have on you growing up? Was she an influence on you?
Oh, yeah, she certainly was. And she was a tremendous influence on my mother also. She was also the daughter of immigrants. She grew up in Denver. She worked in a sweatshop with her mother, doing sewing as a child. But she was a very, and she was a very good student. And so her mother worked to send her to college. And she went to the college, she went to college at University of California, Berkeley. And she was a very fine student there. And she, you know, she majored in classics. I mean, you know, an immigrant daughter majoring in classics is really kind of an odd thing to think about. But she was a very well-read woman, and she was an activist. She actually visited, before she married my grandfather, she took a trip with a bunch of women who were part of her college friends and her graduate school friends to Russia to see what that country was like, you know, now that they'd had the Russian Revolution and what communism was like and so on. And there were a number of well-educated people during the 1930s that flirted with ideas of communism and socialism because, you know, because during the Depression, people were worried that democracy and capitalism wouldn't provide the answer to economic prosperity. You know, we went through many years of hardship, and so people began to explore those alternatives. Also, there had been in Europe a vibrant socialist movement in you know what we now think of Russia and the assorted republics of the former Soviet Union. There had been a serious movement towards socialism. That's what the Russian Revolution was about. There were Jews involved in that movement. So there was a lot of vibrant intellectual community in Europe that was also exploring these issues. They were thinking about, you know, what would be the future of Jews since they had been discriminated against in Russia and other parts of the in Ukraine, all the various countries of Eastern Europe. They wondered, you know, they have we have a long history of dealing with anti-Semitism, a very long history, and it's part of the religious culture and it's part of the secular culture that Jews are aware that they have been outsiders in many places. And they felt safer in America, but they worked extremely hard. And my grandmother was, you know, was one of those. So she became, after she was married, she became a civil rights activist in Omaha in the 1940s. And she was also very active in the National Jewish Women's Organization, Hadassah. And she would go to Hadassah meetings and Hadassah conventions, and she visited Israel, you know, in the 50s with my grandfather, and you know, and was acquainted with some of the leaders of Israel. I mean, it was a small country. It was it was just the beginning, and that's the other stream of thought, actually, that I meant to mention earlier, was that there were Jews who were persuaded that socialism was the answer, and there were other Jews who might have also been socialists, but also became interested in Zionism. And Zionism developed around the turn of the century with Theodor Herzl in Germany. You know, and he was trying to figure out a homeland for the Jews because he sensed the anti-Semitism in Vienna, where he lived. And there were already, you know, there have been rumblings in Germany for many generations, really, that were sort of vaguely anti-Jewish. And then there were, you know, then there was some violence against Jews during Herzl's time and so on. So he grew up in this atmosphere where he was extremely privileged and had a wonderful education, but he was worried about the Jewish problem. And there were many others who also felt that way. And so the first meeting of Zionism took place in the 1890s or early 1900s. I'd have to look up the date. But they were, you know, so they were thinking about what will be our future, where can we live where we'll be safe. And so that movement was also an important piece of the thinking about who we are as Jews. Now, there was a movement of American Jews who were not Zionists, who believed that America was the homeland, and they rejected Zionism. But you know, during the World War II era, many people became, you know, with the destruction of the Holocaust and the founding of the State of Israel, which happened really because they had to do something about all those refugees right. who were wandering around Europe. They began to think more seriously about, you know, where is the place where we'll be safe.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating.
And so,
just fascinating. Hmm? It's fascinating, mm, the history of this and the movement. You know what I want to interrupt again to remind people of who they're listening to? Dr. Sarah Molino, professor of history, and here with me, Frank McKay. And Sarah, you've touched on so much here, but the history of Jews and their feeling of the idea of education is fascinating to me, because I have a mother-in-law now who's, you know, well-educated. She's a social worker. Her parents were Irish, Italian Catholics, and they didn't want her to go to school. And one of the reasons, unfortunately, and it pains me to say it, is they didn't want her to outgrow them. And, we believe that to be the truth. It's amazing to me the foresight of the Jewish people and the understanding of in a historical standpoint of how they viewed education. And your grandfather, having never heard anything about him until now, to me is a heroic figure. The fact that he went out after the death of his wife, and he, you know, he managed to remarry, but this amazing woman who was educated in a time when women weren't being educated, you know, never mind, you know, and anything else. But I mean, to me, it says a tremendous amount about your grandfather and his view of the world. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, as a historian of women, I would just say that, you know, our general knowledge about women's education probably isn't as widely taught in many places. And so we're not familiar with who was educated and when. Jews have traditionally valued study. And study of the religious texts. And so, you know, the wisest man in a little Eastern European town was often the rabbi who spent his days studying the religious texts, the five books, and the commentaries that were written on the Hebrew Bible. One could spend more than a lifetime studying all the stuff that's sure. been written, commentary that's been written about Jewish law. And lots of these commentaries are arguments between scholars about what the right way to interpret the text is. But in any case, that had been a value, and that person would be supported by the community. You know, everybody would donate a little bit of their money to help support the synagogue and to support this rabbi, and they would send their sons, if they could afford it, to study with him for a certain amount of time so that they would know the tradition and be able to pass it down to their family. They did not traditionally educate daughters, but they did have a kind of education for daughters in Eastern Europe, I'm talking about. And then some of this was brought to the United States with the immigrant community. And my father, actually, as a child of immigrants, was sent to a religious school 5 days a week in when he was in, you know, elementary school and probably in high school, or I don't know whether all the way through high school, but certainly through his bar mitzvah. He attended one of these places of learning, and his father was one of those scholars. So his father worked at the synagogue. He and his wife also ran a little delicatessen in Worcester, Massachusetts, and she really ran the business. He, you know, came in and out. He would go to services. You know, traditional Jews pray three times a day, and he was quite religious. And he would also help take care of the synagogue, you know, make sure that the place was cleaned up and the books were in place or whatever needed to be done. It was a very important part of his life. So this is my father's father. And his wife was a much more practical person, and she ran the business. And between the two of them, they made enough money to send their eldest child to college. But, you know, this was seen, Jewish people saw college education or an education in general as a way to upward mobility. Yeah. And so they felt that if their children knew who they were and also were able to, very religious people still do not educate their children in secular subjects beyond about the eighth grade. And this is one of the explanations for all the divides in the Jewish community. Those who send their children to a university or to a college get a much broader education and have a different view of the world. So, you know, if you could see all those pieces in my family, and I think that, you know, they encouraged their sons to go to college. Two of them went, one of them didn't. And one of their daughters went to college. This is my father's family. One of them didn't. So, you know, there was kind of a mixed set of messages about what was the appropriate thing for women to do. But, you know, as the generations, you know, gained a little bit more wealth and they didn't need the children to go to work at a young age, they saw an important investment in education.
Mm, just terrific. Just a terrific view of history from a wonderful woman. And the woman you've been listening to for this last almost hour is Dr. Sarah Molino. And she is a professor emerita for history in Guilford College in North Carolina, and just a wonderful, wonderful career. And we'll be talking more about her and more about her career and her take on history in the upcoming weeks. Frank McKay here, thanking you, Dr. Molino, for a wonderful view here and for being our guest. And of course, we both thank everyone for listening. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Dr. Sarah Molino, everyone, has been our very special guest. Frank McKay signing off.